From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Environmental groups are expressing their concern over President-elect Donald Trump's nomination of Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt to head the EPA. The Sierra Club says having Scott Pruitt in charge of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is like putting an arsonist in charge of fighting fires. But his fellow Oklahoman, Senator Jim Inhofe, says Pruitt has fought back against unconstitutional and overzealous environmental regulations like the Clean Power Plan. Scott Pruitt does come from one of the biggest energy-producing states in the country. He's on record as one of the biggest foes of the EPA, participating in several lawsuits against the agency on issues ranging from air pollution to the Freedom of Information Act to fracking. Joe Wirtz is a reporter at State Impact Oklahoma. He's interviewed Pruitt many times. Joe, even Pruitt says his stand shouldn't be a surprise to people. Just flesh that out.
Yeah, you know, Pruitt is not shy about his close ties with the oil and gas industry. He's they're big political contributors to his campaigns, and he's worked with fossil fuel companies, oil and gas firms in particular, to work together to fight Obama, to fight the EPA, really formed an alliance with them. And Pruitt is not shy about acknowledging that.
Well, in fact, what has Pruitt said to you about the EPA?
Really, you know, Pruitt thinks – you know, Pruitt and a lot of Republican attorneys general, I think the EPA under Obama have adopted an activist agenda, that agenda in lockstep with environmental groups. Here's what he told me in an interview in 2013.
I think the attitude with the EPA and certain environmental groups is that fossil fuels are bad, period. And they're doing everything they can to use the rulemaking process to attack both.
Well, how does that resonate there in Oklahoma? How do people in the state feel about him, maybe, you know, other lawmakers?
So what Pruitt was talking about there is attacks he sees as attacks on coal and natural gas. Supporters here in Oklahoma, you know, think that he's on the right track, that industry does need a defense. Supporters say Pruitt is aggressive and high energy. Todd Hyatt was a Republican speaker of the Oklahoma House when Pruitt was a lawmaker in the state Senate. Those two battled each other in a primary race for lieutenant governor in 2006. Hyatt is now a corporation commissioner, which regulates oil and gas, among other things. But Hyatt says Pruitt is tough, but he expects Pruitt to be pragmatic, a pragmatic reformer at the EPA.
He's going to be thorough. He's going to be fair. He's going to stay within the confines of the law. But at the same time, he's going to look for practical solutions. And I think that's a trademark that he has established through many years of public service.
And Joe Wirtz, what does he point to?
So when they talk about these pragmatic solutions, one thing they talk about is this complicated water dispute here in Oklahoma that was settled this year. And they point to that as proof that Pruitt is capable and interested in building a consensus on divisive issues. This was a water case that was controversial, and you know, they say Pruitt helped broker a deal between the state, a big municipality, and Native American tribes over tricky environmental issues, tribal sovereignty and government rights. So they say Pruitt is capable of building a consensus around controversial issues.
Right. Well, what about climate change? We know that Pruitt wrote in an op-ed earlier this year that the scientists continue to disagree about the degree and extent of global warming and its connection to the actions of mankind. This is, you know, this is a popular opinion, but it's a huge departure from not just scientific opinion, but from previous EPA heads, even from Republican administrations.
Yeah, it's certainly a 180-degree turn from the current mindset at the EPA. As you pointed out, Pruitt has cast doubt on the science of climate change and mankind and industry's role in a warming planet. You know, Pruitt's not shy about being an ally of fossil fuel. He has close ties to the industry, which is economically vital here in Oklahoma and in a lot of states. You know, it's been an unusual move as far as AGs are concerned that Pruitt has essentially collaborated with energy firms to oppose the federal government, to push back against Obama. But Pruitt and other Republican AGs see industry as a key constituent in their states, and they say that Obama and the Obama administration has ignored that industry and that key constituent.
Well, look, the New York Times did a deep investigation in 2014. They reported that Scott Pruitt and other Republican attorneys general had formed an unprecedented secretive alliance with the oil industry, even going so far, according to the New York Times, of at one point sending a letter to the EPA that was actually written almost entirely by the oil and gas producer Devon Energy there in Oklahoma.
Yeah.
So the mandate of the EPA is to protect human health and the environment by developing regulations, studying environmental issues, giving grants. Is this the end of the EPA?
Well, look, you know, Pruitt's supporters say he's going to take his responsibility as a regulator seriously. There's no question that environmental groups seriously doubt that that will be true. But I think it's safe to assume that industry and fossil fuel companies, oil and gas firms, will have a friend at the top of the EPA. Pruitt will still be bound by, you know, the confines of the law, but I think it's likely that industry is going to have a lot more seats at the table than they've had in the last few years.
That's Joe Wirtz, reporter with State Impact Oklahoma, and President-elect Donald Trump's nomination of Scott Pruitt, the attorney general there in Oklahoma, to be his head of the Environmental Protection Agency. Joe, thank you so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Well, now that the Army Corps of Engineers has denied a permit to complete the Dakota Access Pipeline, parties with a vested interest are wondering what's next. For thousands of people who joined the Standing Rock Sioux protest against the pipeline, should they leave or should they stay? Meanwhile, the oil industry and legal experts are trying to make sense of the decision and what it means for the project's fate. Amy Sisk from Here and Now contributor Inside Energy reports.
Here in North Dakota, a treacherous blizzard early this week forced snowplows to work around the clock, and it's tough just trudging down the sidewalk. But for the thousands camped on the frozen prairie, it's much worse. So Chairman Dave Archambault of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe in a YouTube message assures the pipeline is stopped for now.
I'm just asking you that you hear this message and you understand that nothing's going to happen and it's time and it's okay to go home.
But that's easier said than done. The blizzard hit the day after the Corps' announcement, causing thousands of protesters to seek refuge at nearby shelters. Many are not planning to follow Archambault's directive. Morningstar Galley of the Pitt River Tribe in California is staying at Standing Rock's casino. She notes that the pipeline company has not yet packed up its equipment and left.
Until that occurs, there's many protectors, there's many water protectors that have said it's not over with, and we plan to be here until that happens.
She says she plans to return to the frozen camp with her 13-year-old and toddler in tow. While protesters stick around, so does law enforcement. Captain Jesse Johnner of the Cass County Sheriff's Department hops in his truck and drives towards several sites where protesters and police have clashed. He's made many trips here from his home 3 hours to the east to help local officers respond to demonstrations.
If not getting the easement allows a time where people can cool off, people can go home, they can relax, and we can avoid those confrontations, that's great.
Meanwhile, the oil industry and government officials are contemplating the pipeline's future. The Corps of Engineers is launching a much more thorough review of the project, considering alternate routes. But with more than 90% of the line complete and pipe already laid right up to the Missouri River, that's likely to cost pipeline company Energy Transfer Partners billions. One alternative the Corps will consider is a proposal scrapped early on to build the line under the river about 50 miles north of Standing Rock. Here's Craig Stevens with the Midwest Alliance for Infrastructure Now, a group that supports the pipeline.
For them to take a look at this route that was already disqualified years ago is, I think, absurd.
Launching the new review, a thorough environmental impact statement this late in the game, is pretty unusual. And Wyoming-based attorney Karen Bud Fallon calls it unfair. The company assumed it had the go-ahead to build after the original but less detailed environmental assessment.
To have the company spend all that time and all that money just to have the federal government go, oh, just kidding, you can't start it all yet, is a huge economic cost for the company.
And an economic cost to the state. Ron Ness is with the North Dakota Petroleum Council. These severe winter conditions pose problems, he says, for the 30% of North Dakota's crude that's carried on trucks and trains. They are a more expensive mode of transport than the pipeline that was supposed to be operational by now.
You may be delayed today. You may not be getting that oil to the market you want to get to. So it may have some negative impacts on your budget for the near term.
The industry is hopeful Donald Trump will reverse the Corps' decision, but legal experts say it's not so simple. Here's environmental lawyer Luke Danielson.
The government is pretty strongly committed to reevaluating the situation, and I think the courts are pretty likely to ensure that that process of reevaluation goes forward.
Energy Transfer Partners is already challenging the Corps' decision in court. It filed documents earlier this week asking a judge to affirm that it already has the necessary permits to drill under the Missouri River without the final easement from the Corps. For Here and Now, I'm Amy Sisk in Bismarck, North Dakota.
Officially, it's not quite winter yet, but ski season is starting in some places. Many of the trails at Jackson Hole are open now. That Wyoming resort figures prominently in the story of Doug Coombs, who was a pioneer in adventure skiing. He made hundreds of first descents down some of the steepest, most dangerous mountains in the world. But the sport he loved also claimed his life. Coombs died in an accident while skiing in France in 2006 at the age of 48. Rob Cacuzzo tells his story in his book Tracking the Wild Kumba, The Life of Legendary Skier Doug Coombs. When we spoke earlier this year, I asked Rob to tell me how he first became aware of Doug Coombs.
You know, this story starts in my parents' basement. I grew up watching Doug on Warren Miller videos and was just totally taken by the majesty of these mountains that he was dominating, really. He was a superhero in my mind, a real hero, and that's where it started.
And by the way, the kind of skiing that he was doing is not the kind of skiing I would do. Like crazy skiing.
Yeah, it's people call it extreme skiing, although I hazard to use the word extreme because I feel like that has a lot of connotations. You know, in the 90s, people were making extreme tacos and extreme razor blades, and Doug was performing at the highest level of his sport. He was an elite athlete. So there's very little difference between Doug Coombs and Michael Jordan on athleticism. The difference is the playing field.
And you describe some of the runs that he did so beautifully in this book. But give me an example of like the kind of trail that Doug Coombs would ski.
Well, I think the big defining element is the severity of the pitch. It was extremely steep. So we're talking about between 35 degrees and 60 degrees in some cases. And it's really hard to wrap your mind around how steep that is until you are standing on a pitch like that, which is part of the motivation for me to seek out some of these runs. It's so steep that the line between flying and skiing is almost indistinguishable.
Hmm.
And it can be a completely unnerving experience, that idea that if you were to fall, you would just tumble and tumble, tomahawk, head to toe, head to toe, head to toe, until you either go over the edge of a cliff, hit into a rock, or safely, hopefully end up at the bottom.
We have some sound from a documentary that featured Doug Coombs. It's called Steep. And here he is talking about why he loved to ski.
When I go out, I become more alive. And it's probably the endorphins that everyone talks about. And I guess the more you produce, the more you want. And so I think I've been producing a lot for a long time because I want them all the time.
You're smiling as you listen to that.
Yeah, I mean, he's – what I learned in the process of researching his story was that Doug, beyond a skier, was a remarkable human being that possessed a positivity and an optimism that just he imparted in other people. I had the privilege of meeting these people along my journey and being able to witness that positivity kind of emit from them and this part of him that he left behind with them. And so just to hear his voice really – it kind of brings back a lot of those faces that I saw along my journey.
And your journey, by the way, you went to basically retrace his steps to some of the most important places that he went in the course of his life and career. You went and talked to the people that he knew, to the people. And in fact, in many cases, you simply ran into the people who knew him very well when you would arrive in some of these ski towns.
Yeah, there was an unbelievable serendipity about this whole experience. It was as if there was some type of energy in the cosmos directing my journey. And I was so fortunate to have these moments where the person I was looking for would arrive in front of me. And it was just too surreal to think it was somewhat of a coincidence. So I, not to get too cosmic here, I do believe that we all possess this certain energy and certain people stoke that energy to this roaring blaze in their life. So even when they're gone, you can still seek it out and feel that energy.
How did he get into skiing?
He started skiing much like I began skiing. He grew up in Bedford, Massachusetts. He was a part of a ski family. And they started taking trips up to New Hampshire, much like my family.
They also started at, I believe, Neshoba Valley, which is the first place I ever skied in my life.
Yeah, it's amazing that the king of the steeps, the person that conquered some of the biggest mountains in the world, started at 240-foot molehill in Massachusetts. Right. And that's what really started me off with this quest, is that how does a guy go from this modest little place to then, you know, what were the qualities that brought him and directed him? And so I tried to follow those footsteps and try to glean what that was.
And he wasn't afraid. I think that was a key thing about him. He wasn't afraid. And the things that a lot of us would be very scared of.
That's true. And I think it comes down to a matter of perspective. He was seeing the ways that he could stay alive versus the ways that could kill him. A lot of these athletes who I was able to speak to, similar to Doug Coombs, they're experts in managing risk and understanding risk and minimizing risk. So when we look at a character like Doug Coombs, we see all the ways that he could fall and get killed. But for him, he's seeing the snow that will keep him alive. And Coombs had this ability to not only stoke his own confidence to achieve these feats, but impart that confidence to the people he was skiing with, the clients he had, the friends he had, the family that skied with him. He could impart this unbelievable confidence to allow them to achieve seemingly impossible things in the mountains.
There was a word that we heard Doug Coombs use in that clip we played, talking about endorphins.
Absolutely.
And when you talk about some of his clients, these are people who would tell you that they felt something when they were skiing with him because of the insane runs that he would take them on.
Oh, absolutely.
That they had never felt before. It made them feel almost like their daily lives were worthless because this put them in such an incredible state.
No, it's just true. I mean, you kind of have to picture it. You're standing on the top of a peak in this spectacular place where all you can see is mountains into the distance, and you're standing next to this 6-foot being who is just he's like a golden retriever. He's just thrilled to be there with you, and he's imparting this confidence within you. And then you're looking down at a run that could kill you, and you're terrified, and he's standing there with you and telling you, you know what, you got this, and this is how we're going to do it. And then you do it, and you overcome that fear, and you feel this rush of just endorphins and euphoria and true just bliss to be in nature and have done that.
And Doug Coombs went on to become legendary at Jackson Hole, mm-hmm. and then get kicked out of Jackson Hole and told he wasn't allowed to ski there anymore.
Yeah, it was an amazing kind of sequence of events. Coombs is known for breaking the boundaries. That's the way he was his whole life. And in Jackson Hole at the time, the boundaries were pretty staunch. And what ended up happening was he was part of a posse of skiers that were pushing the boundaries, going to the backcountry to explore these untracked powder fields. And the ski patrol wasn't a big fans of that. And as a result, they ultimately kicked him out.
Was it fair what they did, do you think?
I think that's a tough question to answer. From the perspective of the ski patrol, they were enforcing a mandate that was handed down to them from the National Forest. However, Coombs represented such great value to Jackson Hole. It was so emblematic of what was happening there in the sport that to kick him out was almost shooting themselves in the foot. And then, of course, only a couple years later, he's welcomed back with open arms. And they eventually adopt a open gate policy to the backcountry, which has become kind of the crown jewel of their marketing. So Coombs almost precipitates this future in skiing that we have today, which is backcountry skiing. And he was just ahead of the curve.
And after being kicked out of Jackson Hole, he and his wife made their home in another beautiful resort in France called La Grave, right?
Right. Yep, exactly. And it was very appropriate that he would end up in La Grave. La Grave is the small ski town of about 500 people. And its claim to fame is really that it has no ski patrol, has no boundary ropes, has no mark runs, no mark cliffs. There's one lift that takes you to the top, and you need to figure your way down. And if you don't know how to get down, the only real way off is to get picked up by a helicopter. So it's as serious as it possibly gets.
So how did he die?
He died in an accident trying to save a young protege of his. There was a young man named Chad Vanderham who, much like myself, was just taken by this Doug Coombs person. And Chad followed Doug around the world and set his mind to becoming a mountain guide just like Doug, and found his way to La Grave, France. And they were skiing a run in 2006. And he went over the edge of this cliff.
Fell hundreds of feet.
Yes. He fell quite a distance. Doug then, seeing that his young protege had had fallen immediately goes into rescue mode to try to make a rescue, and he ultimately too falls off the edge of the cliff and falls to his death.
And there were two other skiers there with them.
Yes.
And you spoke with one of them.
Yeah, I spoke with both of them, but I spoke with one of them in Le Grave, Christina Blomqvist, not far from where they actually had set off on this final run. And it was probably the most powerful moment of my life, asking these very these very serious questions about this accident, and for her to reveal to me the moments before his death, and then also just the moments of, you know, after the accident, what they did to try to help them.
Well, one of the things that I noticed and was wondering about as I was reading this, and you tell in such great detail the things that he did, and then as you go looking to find out more answers about his life and his death, is why you were so interested in him that you went through all of this trouble.
It was almost – there was a moment where I just felt like the story had chosen me, and it became this rewarding experience of I'm going on the greatest adventure of my life directed by this man who I never met. But I also wanted to answer those fundamental questions. How does a guy that had a very similar childhood as my own become who he became? And I figured the only way to really answer that was to try to follow his footsteps and ski in his tracks.
Did you figure out how he became what he became?
I think it really comes down to, beyond his athleticism, it comes down to this positive optimism, this real beautiful energy that he was able to not only hone but radiate and share with other people. And I think that that's a lesson that I hope people take away from this book, is he had one life to lead. The impact he made still reverberates off of so many people, and it's just a beautiful legacy of a man.
That's Rob Cacuzzo. His new book is called Tracking the Wild Kumba, The Life of Legendary Skier Doug Coombs. Rob, thanks so much.
Jeremy, a pleasure.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. Blue Apron knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals, so they follow the highest quality standards and deliver recipes along with just the right amount of ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. New recipes are created each week by Blue Apron's culinary team, so you can customize your recipes each week. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. There's no weekly commitment, so pick what you want at blueapron.com/here.
The great sports writer Peter Gammons has an annual concert called Hot Stove Cool Music. It's in Boston and in Chicago. It's to benefit the foundation run by Theo Epstein, who's managed winning baseball teams in both those cities. It's called Hot Stove after the Hot Stove League, the fans who'd gather around the hot stove this time of year to talk about players and next season. Well, teams are in talks right now as well. And just this week, the New York Yankees signed closer Aroldis Chapman to the largest contract ever for a relief pitcher, 5 years for $86 million. And the Boston Red Sox traded for Chicago White Sox left-hander Chris Sale, one of the top starting pitchers in baseball. So let's gather around the hot stove with Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. And Mike, put what's happening in context for us. How big are these deals with these two pitchers?
Well, I think Chris Sale is a huge deal because starting pitchers have a big impact on the game. And this is the Red Sox saying, we are here to win and we're here to win now. Their ace, the ace of their rotation, is David Price. And he's a good to great pitcher, but in the postseason, he has been rather bad. He tweets about this and acknowledges this on Twitter. And so the Red Sox, at a pretty decent price, you know, 12 to 13 million for probably the best pitcher in the American League over the last few years, really bolster their rotation. Good signing for them, I'd say.
Well, the Yankees general manager Brian Cashman says the Sox are now the Golden State Warriors of baseball after this trade. So flesh that out.
I think maybe it's a dig because the Golden State Warriors did really well in the regular season, but of course lost to the Cleveland Cavaliers. Although maybe it's a compliment in trying to set up his Yankees as an underdog. However, I would, that's a fine line. I'll give him on the rhetoric. On the actual signing of Aroldis Chapman, I do not think this was a great deal. And here's why. Relief pitchers, even guys who could throw 100, 104 miles an hour like Chapman, they don't wear well over time. Even if you lose a couple couple miles an hour through age, through injury, you get less effective. Perhaps the Yankees were overly influenced by their history with Mariano Rivera, the greatest relief pitcher of all time, and also one of the healthiest relief pitchers of all time. They built that recent Yankees dynasty on the fact that he would be there to close games. And so maybe that's what they're thinking about, that we'll have Chapman at the highest price ever paid for a relief pitcher. The problem is they're not ready to win games. They had a winning season somewhat unexpectedly last year, but they're not really ready to contend for a World Series in the next few years. So you have a five-year contract. The Yankees might be ready to win the World Series in years 3, 4, or 5 of the contract. Chapman might be diminishing in skills from years 3, 4, or 5. Let's also throw into the mix, Chapman played for the Yankees this year. They like him as a person. However, it's a domestic violence charge that he was suspended for baseball, shot a gun into his garage, was involved in some, you know, driving incidents. So even if they like him and think he was a good person, these brushes with the law have got to concern you.
Well, but isn't the other problem, we only have less than a minute, but how do smaller market teams who don't have this TV money, how do they compete? I mean, after the Cubs win, what's the winning formula?
You got to be smart. You got to get these young players at a discount, and the Cubs did. And even the Cubs' big free agent signing was Justin Hayward, and he was their one of the worst components of the team. So you have to win on the cheap with guys that you develop through your system, young players, and then maybe you get one or two high-profile free agents. But they're a big risk, and if one or two goes wrong, your team's not going to win.
Mike Pesca, host of the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com. Mike, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
One of President-elect Trump's central campaign promises was to enact stricter immigration policies and to deport immigrants who are in the country illegally, starting with those who have committed crimes, which Trump says is about 2 or 3 million people. He also pledged to end President Obama's executive actions on immigration. These statements are causing anxiety among immigrants and advocates across the country. And joining us now via Skype is Ahilan Arulanantham, who is the director of advocacy and legal director at the ACLU of Southern California. He's also a 2016 MacArthur Fellow. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
And what kind of questions have you been getting from immigrants about their situations since the election of Trump?
There's certainly a lot of fear. And I've gotten both very specific questions about people's particular immigration status and have also gotten more general questions about would the president-elect have the power to do? Can he really make good on many of the statements that he made during the campaign? Questions like that.
And can he? What are you telling them?
Well, the Due Process Clause has not been abolished. Every person is protected by the Due Process Clause under the Fifth Amendment. So there's a longstanding body of law that governs how the government can treat people when it wants to deport them. Most obviously that in most cases, not in all, but in most cases, have to go in front of an immigration judge who has an obligation to provide a fair hearing. So that imposes significant constraints on what anyone, any administration can do by way of trying to deport people who it claims are here unlawfully.
But when it comes to the issue of due process, you just argued before the Supreme Court basically on this issue about whether people who are detained have a right to try to persuade a judge that they ought to be released.
Yes. And I thought it was very significant that although there seemed to be a lot of disagreement about how you implement the due process protections for such people, there didn't seem to me anyway to be a lot of dispute that there are limits created by the Constitution as to how long you can hold somebody without a hearing. You know, the government's kind of core position, which is you can hold people for as long as it takes, and there really are no constraints on their power to hold people, to detain people in you know, prison-like conditions and immigration detention, really didn't. It didn't seem like there was anyone who was endorsing that view amongst the justices on the bench.
When you hear Donald Trump say he just wants to deport the criminals who are in this country illegally, what do you hear there? Because some people would say they're all criminals because they are here without documentation. So how do you decide who's one of the few million that Trump plans to deport quickly?
Many people who are going through the deportation process have not committed a crime in order to come here. And whether or not that was true, they have lawful status now. You know, so the two biggest chunks of people, for example, that were at issue in the Supreme Court case that we argued are lawful permanent residents, that's green card holders, who have been convicted of a crime and have finished serving their sentence. And now the government is trying to strip away their green card and deport them because of the fact that they had been convicted. Because you have a lot of people, for example, convicted of simple drug possession. Now, the law subjects you to deportation in that situation, but it gives judges the discretion to choose to let that person stay if, for example, they have a spouse or a child who is dependent on them and they've lived in this country for a long period of time, or they've gone through successful rehabilitation since the offense and things like that. You know, then you have other people who have overstayed visas. That's not a crime to overstay your visa. Or, for example, many of them are people who fled from persecution and they arrived at the border, sometimes from the most violent countries on earth, and asked for asylum. And our law has protected that since World War II. We have protected the right of people who have fled persecution and now more recently or torture to come to the United States and have a safe haven here. And so people like that also, it doesn't make any sense to say, ah, well, you've broken a law, and so we have to deport you. Well, you know, in many cases, they didn't break a law. They came to the border and asked for asylum because they were fleeing violence.
Is that the kind of person that you think he's talking about, though, when he says he's going to deport criminals?
You know, there's a lot of ambiguity in the statements that Donald Trump has made, so it's really hard to know. I would hope he's not talking about that, and I would hope that people trying to implement or listen to his policies don't think of people like that. I've heard him say we're talking about 2 or 3 million people who are criminals.
Right.
You know, but there aren't 2 or 3 million people who are convicted of deportable offenses.
Well, let me ask you about another thing that he said, which is that Obama has deported so many immigrants over his time in office, about 2.9 million between 2009 and 2014. So I, Trump, am not doing anything drastically different than what he's been doing.
Yes, we'll see what he does, but that statement is absolutely correct. President Obama has been perhaps the most draconian enforcer of the immigration laws in modern history. And particularly when it comes to detention, you know, the argument that that I was making in the Supreme Court, I mean, that's not the Trump administration. That's the Obama administration defending a rule that you can lock people up for years without giving them a hearing in front of a judge just to ask if they can be released because they're not a danger or a flight risk. And you know, the Obama administration now is sort of tonight, there will be something like 41 or 42,000 people who will go to sleep in an immigration detention center. And that is by far the highest number in the history of the country. Most of those people, well over half of them, have no criminal conviction.
What do you say to the Dreamers, the people who are affected by DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, that was an executive order by President Obama? Donald Trump has said that's unconstitutional and he wants to immediately terminate it. So are they in trouble? Are they, should they be worried?
I think, unfortunately, that they should be worried. I think it's going to be a very important early test of the administration as to whether those threats or promises, whatever you want to call them, end up being carried out. Because you know, even if you can't agree on every aspect of immigration enforcement, it should be easy to agree that people who were brought here as children by their parents, who didn't even know in many cases, you know, what their immigration status was until they were teenagers or young adults, and that have known no other country, that the people like that really ought to be given the right to stay here. And there was quite widespread bipartisan support for that idea. And it'll be interesting to see if the administration insists on the, in my view, unjust treatment of those people that the president-elect has suggested he might undertake.
Do you think that he will stick to that, or do you think he's going to soften on it?
Who knows? You know, it's no one ever made any money trying to predict what Donald Trump would do. And it's very, very hard to say. Certainly the people who have been discussed as being in charge of immigration enforcement are people who really represent the radical fringe of immigration enforcement viewpoints, and the people who really are out of step with what the vast majority of Americans, really on both sides of the Democrat-Republican aisle, think about immigration enforcement.
As somebody who knows the immigration system in this country better than probably anybody else, do you think that if we were simply to dramatically beef up our staff dealing with immigration and our government agencies dealing with immigration, that we could process people and do things the right way and everything would work out okay? We wouldn't have all of these issues with people who are here without documentation? Or is that a kind of a separate issue?
No, I think that's the resource shortages within the immigration court system are a huge part of the problem. And you know, the two things that the system needs more than anything else, it needs lawyers for immigrants, because that's not just as a matter of fairness, but because it speeds up the system, makes it much more efficient, and decreases the amount of time that people spend in immigration detention and the amount of time the cases spend on the docket. And then it needs far more immigration judges. Immigration judges' average caseload is around 1,900 cases pending open at a time. Those are a huge factor in the way the system runs.
Well, Ahilan Arulananthum, Director of Advocacy and Legal Director at the ACLU of Southern California, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Pizzagate seems too cheery a characterization for the fake news story that almost turned tragic. We've talked here about the online lie pushed by the son of Donald Trump's new national security advisor and others that Hillary Clinton was running a child sex ring out of the Comic Ping Pong Pizza Parlor in D.C., a lie that led Edgar Madison Welch to drive there to liberate the non-existent children, firing an assault rifle in the process. Today, he tells the New York Times he was sorry about the rifle, but still believes the story. Also this week, a Florida woman, Lucy Richards, was indicted for making death threats to Lenny Posner, whose child Noah was murdered in the Sandy Hook massacre. The woman believed the lie pushed by radio host Alex Jones that the school bloodbath was a hoax. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik is here. And David, we've talked about this fake news. Now it's producing chargeable offenses. So what do we know about what Lucy Richards did and said?
Well, I've listened to some of the threats that she made, leaving voicemails for the parents of one of the children killed at Sandy Hook Elementary in Newtown, Connecticut, in that massacre there several years ago. And, you know, I mean, it's a disjointed series of racial and ethnic epithets, sort of vile vitriol being propagated in all directions against gays, against anything you could mention. But also she said, you know, you're going to die. Death is coming to you. And while she didn't say that it was going to be by her hand, she didn't say how it was going to happen. This is clear as presented by prosecutors' presentation of a threat and just the, you know, the ugliness, ugliest pain imaginable inflicted upon the surviving parents of this child.
Well, this underscores that the fake news of this election that's much talked about is not new. And you know that if you've been listening to radio host Alex Jones or other far-right outlets. But how did Sandy Hook start?
Well, it started almost immediately. You know, I think that there are people who are conspiracy theorists who just seized upon this, in, you know, almost in the hours or days, immediate aftermath of this massacre, as I say. But, you know, we shouldn't limit it entirely. You can go back to the 9/11 attacks, the terror attacks on this nation. There are people called truthers. You know, you can think of the birthers who claim President Obama wasn't blamed here. You can go back to the mid-90s and President Clinton era where people claim that the ATF were these jackbooted thugs who were going to descend from the skies in black helicopters to take away people's guns. And, you know, this cuts across ideologies in some ways. But the one common thread between that conspiracy and what we saw after Sandy Hook and Newtown, that massacre, was that for some who are extremely susceptible, shall we say, to conspiracy theories and hoaxes, and who also are adamant about the preservation of the right of gun owners, there was this notion that somehow a threat was being propagated to the possession of guns. guns, that this would be used not only to tighten certain kinds of gun regulations, but also to take them away entirely, neither of which proved the case under President Clinton or President Obama.
Well, to the pizza story, this all began after the email account of John Podesta, the top aide to Hillary Clinton, was hacked, and users on the online message board 4chan noticed one of the emails was with James Alefantis, who's the owner of the pizza parlor, and they were talking about a Clinton fundraiser there, and people like Welch, the man who went with the rifle, thought the word pizza was code. The New York Times interviewed Edgar Welch, again, the man who went with the gun, who was arrested. The paper didn't print a complete transcript, but your thoughts on how that interview was crafted?
Well, it seemed to me that they did a Q&A after interviewing him from where he was being held. And it seemed to me both a very quick way of getting information up. They didn't have to wait to process the story in a news, and also a way to ensure that people who might be skeptical of the mainstream media, that is, people who themselves might give these hoaxes, these conspiracy theories, not really fake news, but let's call them hoaxes, what they are.
Or lies, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or lies. Mm-hmm. Who give them credence by putting – allowing him to speak in his own words more fully, it may lend more credence in their minds to what the New York Times, a place toward, you know, for which they may have some skepticism, is presenting in that case. Yeah. And I think also it's worth pointing out, you know, these emails being teased apart for code words, you know, by giving too much detail of how it happens, and we can do that, but nonetheless, it almost gives too much credence here. People were essentially inventing meanings without any evidence or reason to back it up, yeah. And imputing it to Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman John Podesta, and accusing her and him of somehow being involved in a child sex trafficking ring that simply did not and does not exist.
Well, let's look at why they do. Welch says he listens to Alex Jones. Again, this is the radio show host and founder of the site InfoWars. Here he is talking about Hillary Clinton.
Now it's out in the open. We've got the Clintons involved in hardcore Satanism, blood rituals, Aleister Crowley stuff. The WikiLeaks have released it. Google has had to authenticate it. WikiLeaks has come out and linked to sites that are reporting this is about child trafficking. Haitian children.
David Falkenflip, we got less than a minute. What do you do with that?
God, what do you do with it? I mean, there you have a guy who's in a bizarre and baroque way, you could call him a talented performer. But what he's not doing is propagating information. What he's doing is he's propagating disinformation. And one of the things he did in the pizza episode that is the most troubling is, you know, just a few days before this person drove up from North Carolina and shot up that pizza place, thankfully hurting no one, Jones himself said, you know, I may need to go to all these pizzeria places and check them out for myself. This is something I'm going to have to do in person. And, you know, that's exactly what this man armed did a few days later, thankfully with no deaths, but that's not necessarily a guaranteed outcome.
David Falkenflik, NPR media correspondent. We're going to stay on this one. Thank you so much.
You bet.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.